they did it. We all can see that they are under control, but the government, Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, keep supporting the Hong Kong police. That's why we Hong Kong people, we Hong Kong protesters, much more angry and much more feel that we need to go out, we need to voice out, and we need to fight for the democracy of Hong Kong.
And Chris, I understand that you're quite young yourself. You're in your 20s?
Yeah, 20-something.
And so you are going to go back to the Chinese University of Hong Kong, which is one of the two, or actually there's a handful of universities that have become these sites of protest right now. Is that going to continue?
Just now, the war in the university are in. Because we changed from the Chinese University of Hong Kong to the Poly University. But because of the different kind of the reason, the police fight into the university and the protesters are very tired. We are trying to escape from the university instead of we staying there to keep fighting.
And when you say escape from the universities, are police preventing you from leaving?
Yes. Police was saying that you guys just go away, we are not going to arrest you. But when they claim that there's an exit that protester can go, when the protester were trying to escape the university, the police was using the tear gas, was using the water cannon to fight the protester and do the arrest. And it is very nonsense that one government or one police force are doing like that.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and I want to wish you good luck. Really appreciate this time and, you know, putting yourself out there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for supporting Hong Kong. We just hope the whole world is can stand with Hong Kong and fight for the freedom. Thank you.
My guest has been Chris. He's using a pseudonym to protect his identity, also wearing a mask for our TV audience. He's a protester active in Hong Kong's movements. And we've been discussing the ongoing mass movement for democracy in Hong Kong. I'm Sonali Kohatkar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, The Struggle with Olivia and Alyssa.
Lordy me, yes, it's so lordy mad. Who's gonna be your man?
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society concert season. On Friday, November 22nd, the Honey Whiskey Trio returns to the PFS stage. Prior to the concert, the Honeys will conduct a vocal workshop. Attendees will learn shape note singing, body percussion, and shout songs. The workshop will be held from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., followed by the concert starting at 7:30, doors at 7. The concert and workshop will be held at Reedwood French Church at 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Runaway Inequality, an activist guide to economic justice with Les Leopold on Saturday, November 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in Portland. Les Leopold co-founded the Labor Institute. He's in Portland to talk about his latest book, Runaway Inequality, an activist guide to economic justice. Again, that's Runaway Inequality, an activist guide to economic justice with Les Leopold on Saturday, November 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We will not bow down to racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm gonna stand. I'm gonna stand.
Now this is time for free your mind and your soul. Yo, our story has never been told. Ladies, you got to demand what you want, and what we want is respect, right?
Come and take a walk with me. Cross a walk with these. See what only I can see.
Sisters, check this. Watch this.
Opportunity, you in jeopardy. Yo, yo, set me free, don't hinder me, let me be.
I'm fighting for freedom, I got the heat in case you need them. A straight soldier, ain't nobody told ya.
We've been together since I created border. The African border celebration is in order.
My only chance of being free is to fly within me, and it's illegal to kill a freaking eagle. A bird is never more important than my people. I guess we didn't need them, so I took away his freedom.
Believe that we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of critical resistance. I guess you have to be probably at least 40 or so, or close to 40, or older to experience this sense of incredulity. It really does seem like it was yesterday, doesn't it, Cassandra? Gina and Linda and Dorsey. But then on the other hand, when you consider the vastly changed public consciousness regarding prisons and policing, then you realize that critical resistance has accomplished so much within such a relatively short period of time. So I want to begin by thanking all of those who have kept the organization and the movement going over the last two decades. Jess, Lily, Mohammed, Rachel, of course, Isaac, Ari, and many, many more. We know that their stunning work would never have been possible without the dedication and brilliance of Rose Brass. And I know that we dedicate this 20th anniversary celebration to Rose's memory. Her legacy is the glue that has held together the radical organizing, the transformative politics, and the abolitionist philosophy of critical resistance. Thank you, Rose. I would like us also to think about the people in prison who can't be here. We can never forget that our comrades in struggle, many of our comrades in struggle, are behind bars and are unable to be with us in person. But we thrive because their ideas have been the driving force to the work that we have done. As extensive and as out in the open as organizing around prison issues is today, from one end of the political spectrum to the other, it may be difficult to realize that before the first CR conference, while radical anti-prison organizing was happening, activists were largely unaware of the work their counterparts were doing in various parts of the country. There was work around political prisoners, educational work within jails and prisons, a lot of unrecognized work with women in prison. There were organizations that had recently formed and older organizations from the 1960s and the 1970s. But it was not until that conference actually took place that we came to recognize just how many people were actually doing this work all over the country and in many parts of the world. Those of us on the organizing committee all remember that we were hoping to attract a few hundred people. And I think we talked about 350 or so, right? That would have been a major success. But as it turned out, as many of you know, 3,500 people showed up at UC Berkeley for that conference in September of 1998. And the Critical Resistance Conference, which took place a little more than 20 years ago, served as a catalyst for a much needed movement, for a movement that developed a more complex analysis of the relationship between the soaring prison population, rising racism, declining resources for poor people, people of color. And you know, I was trying to think of the names of all of the people who were involved, and I know that some of them are missing. But I went and pulled out the poster. And the names of the organizing committee begin with Ellen Berry, then Jennifer Beach, Rose Braz, and Julie Brown. But I know that for some reason, Bo Rita Brown's name isn't here, and I don't know why. Cynthia Chandler, Kamari Clark, Angela Davis, Leslie Di Benedetto Skopek, Gita Drury, Rain Galbraith, Nanine Karaka, Stephanie Kelly, Terry Coopers, Rachel Lederman, Joyce Miller, Dorsey Nunn, Dylan Rodriguez, Eli Rosenblatt, Cassandra Shaler, Andy Smith, Nancy Stoller, Julia Sudbury, Robin Templeton, Saran Thrift, Greg Winter. But there were many, many others. So what names am I missing here? Gina Dent, absolutely. What other names?
George Galvin.
Who?
George Galvin.
I'm sorry, the acoustics aren't that good here, so I'm having trouble making.
George Galvos.
George Galvos, right. Thank you, thank you. Thank you for the clarity of your voice. Anyone else? Yeah, why don't you just call the names out? Well, actually, Ruthie is listed as a member of the advisory committee, but you're absolutely right. She was involved in the actual organizing. And there are other people. Donna Wilmot, I know Donna is here. I saw her earlier. Adrian Wing. Partial list of sponsors, Blessing Way Foundation. I know that Ed Cohen gave us $50,000, which is about all of the money we had. And what was so incredible, I don't have a lot of time, so I can't go off script, but what was so incredible was that we did not have a single paid organizer. But the organizers reflected a broad group of activists, of scholars, advocates, and our major concern was to assist in the production of a popular understanding of the reasons for the rising numbers of people in prison. And also, of course, to take up the call for abolition that, as Rachel pointed out, had come out of the prison movement in the early 1970s. We were intent on developing an anti-racist, anti-capitalist, feminist approach that would be what now is frequently referred to as intersectional. We wanted to avoid easy answers and to encourage a kind of a complexity in our understanding that would challenge the idea that there were any easy fixes. And we especially wanted to challenge prison reform. And I actually get quite angry today when people refer to us as prison reformers. The two terms that we tried to offer to the movement were prison industrial complex and abolition. There was no easy solution to the problem because we were dealing not with a simple issue, but with an amalgam of economic and political and cultural and representational forces that were responsible
in a complex way for the hegemonic notion that black people, indigenous people, people of color, poor people, trans people, and others were naturally inclined to criminality. And that the only way to address this was to put people in prison. So we had to do what we then called, borrowing a strategy from Stuart Hall, is we had to disarticulate crime and punishment. We had to pull the causal connection of crime and punishment apart and begin to think about the reasons why people were really in prison, not because they had committed a crime, but because of racism, because of the fact that politicians were winning elections by exploiting the notion of law and order. Corporations were profiting. Established media were riding the ways of these ideas for their own successes. Architects were benefiting from the rise in the prison population. Telephone companies, the construction industry was expanding. There were new prisons and jails in California. As a matter of fact, there was something like a 500% increase from the early 80s to the early 90s. And so therefore, we decided that we would call our conference Critical Resistance because resistance was critical at that point. It was crucial, it was urgent. But at the same time, we had to be critical in our resistance. And I think those meanings are still very much indicative of why critical resistance is so important. Critical resistance beyond the prison industrial complex. And we thought that by using this term critical and prison industrial complex, which Mike Davis had actually used in an article that was written about the transformation of the California economy from an agricultural economy to a prison-based economy. We decided to use that for the whole phenomenon, which would mean that we would have to address a whole range of issues. Capitalism, the media, the politicians, et cetera, et cetera. As a matter of fact, I brought the call to the conference, too. And, you know, those were the days when we actually had to reproduce these flyers. Almost 2 million people are currently locked up in U.S. prisons and jails, the majority of whom are people of color. Since 1980, the population of prisons has tripled, and it is expected to double again by 2005. While imprisoned populations are overwhelmingly male, the number of women prisoners is increasing at an even greater rate than men, et cetera, et cetera. The growing reliance on imprisonment as a solution to systemic social problems, combined with the mounting corporate interest in an ever-expanding punishment industry, has led to the emergence of a late 20th century prison industrial complex. And we all go on to point out that this prison industrial complex, which includes private and super maximum prisons, we were just beginning to really learn about supermaxes at that time, not only violates the civil and human rights of incarcerated men and women, but it poses grave threats to the very future of democracy in our country and throughout the world. And I also brought the call for papers, which I don't have time to read because it's a legal size sheet. But I do want to read the very last paragraph. The conference is structured to encourage participants to engage with others outside their own fields of expertise. Thus, each panel must reflect two or more of the above subject areas. And the above subject areas included things like prisoners' industry, abolitionist alternatives, et cetera. And each panel must include presenters from diverse backgrounds who are capable of addressing issues of race, gender, sexuality, age, et cetera. And we got some of the most amazing proposals. A very good friend of mine who lives in Australia by the name of Amanda George, I first met her by reading her proposal. In any event, there's no way that I can adequately assess the importance of the work Critical Resistance has done over the last two decades. Of course, there were those of us who helped to organize the conference, but the real work was done by the activists in the aftermath of that conference, Rachel and Isaac and Rose, who was a member of the organizing committee. Without the steadfast commitment of CR activists and those with whom they have worked in other affiliated organizations, we would not have witnessed the rise of movements calling not for reform, but for the abolition of the existing system of punishment and policing. There are two points that I want to try to make. I realize that I could speak for the next 5 hours about the importance of critical resistance. But I want to confine myself to, I'm not going to speak for, I think I have at the most 10 minutes left. And probably less than that, because Lily's going to give me a time sheet probably very soon. But what we were attempting to point out was that the rise of the prison industrial complex represented the articulation of structural racism with global capitalism. The 1980s, of course, was the period during which all over the world we witnessed the rise of global capitalism and neoliberal ideology. We were witnessing the effects of the deindustrialization of the economy, the migration of capitalist corporations, like especially in auto and steel, to other countries where labor forces were cheaper. This is how the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue actually made his money. You know what I'm talking about, right? So these developments were combined with the decline of the welfare state and thus the disestablishment of institutions that had been designed to assist poor people when unemployment and lack of resources made it impossible for people to live normal lives. This was the period when we were witnessing the privatization of healthcare, the privatization of education, also the outsourcing of prison services to private corporations, as well as outright privatization. This is why it was necessary to consider other institutional changes. So we were thinking about health, the health industry. We were thinking about education. But what I think is especially important today and relevant today is the fact that the very same conditions that were leading to the incarceration of ever larger numbers of people of color and poor people, especially women, were causing people from the global south, whose economies were also affected by global capitalism, to try to seek ways to migrate to places where they might find hope for better lives. And I mention this because people don't often make the connection between the rise of the prison industrial complex and the conditions that have unleashed the various migrations. Well, first of all, the migration of corporations, because they were the first to migrate, right? Nobody ever called them illegal, when they moved to other countries. So. And so I mention this because immigrant detention is now an integral element of the prison industrial complex. And because the conditions underlying migration from countries like Honduras and Guatemala and Nicaragua are very much related to the conditions responsible for the increase in structural racism inside the US and the increase during the 80s and 90s of the numbers of people behind bars. The other point that I want to make has to do with the global scope of the prison industrial complex, and we might say prison and police industrial complex. I just actually arrived back in the country this morning. Gina Dent and I were in Brazil yesterday, attending a national conference of black women that took place in Goiânia, in the state of Goiás. The theme of the conference was Black Women Against Racism and Violence, and for life, or for the good life. It's kind of hard to translate from the Portuguese. They are addressing exactly the same conditions that are even more repressive in Brazil. Brazil now has the third largest prison population in the world, with an ever-expanding network of prisons. This is complemented by racist police violence that clearly surpasses what our experience of the horrors of police violence in this country. And there are the related violences of femicide and suicide. Some months ago, you may be familiar with this assassination that happened some months ago of Marielle Franco, who was a radical anti-violence and anti-racist queer activist, and she was an elected official, a member of the City Council of Rio de Janeiro. So often received solidarity from people in Brazil for the struggles that we are engaged in here. And I think now is the time to generate solidarity in our ranks. We've learned how important it has been to develop links with Palestinian resistors, how our call for justice for Palestine has helped to enrich the very meaning of abolition, not only for Palestine, but for us in the US. Because the election of Bolsonaro was clearly inspired by the election of Trump here in the US. Oh, I was not supposed to mention his name, I'm sorry. Because sometimes we get too ensconced in the moment and we fail to think about the long term and how we really represent the future. But it is our responsibility to stand with our Brazilian comrades to defend the legacy of Marielle Franco and to say no to military policing, to prison expansion, and to racist violence in Brazil, in the US, and throughout the world. And so that's all I have to say. I'm not leaving, so you can sit down. Because I was asked to make remarks for 15 or 20 minutes, and I hope I remained within the guidelines. Did I? Okay. So my next task is to introduce the panelists who are going to engage in each other in conversation, and I will serve as the moderator. I'm not going to do as amazing as an introduction as Rachel did. For me, I feel really that I'm coming up short here. But I'd like to first introduce Kamau Walton. I do have a few words to say. Kamau is a member of Critical Resistance. They joined CR Oakland in 2010, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Kamau was a key organizer in the Victorious Stop the Injunction campaign, supporting outreach, mobilizations, community events to build up Oaklanders' resistance to policing. Kamau also was involved in mobilizing and organizing the movement to abolish solitary confinement in California following the 2013 prison hunger strikes. And they were an early organizer in the Stop Urban Shield campaign. And yes, let's once again celebrate that Critical Resistance, together with the Arab Resource Organizing Committee and a number of other organizations, got rid of Urban Shield. The next person I want to introduce is Linda Evans. Linda is a co-founder of All of Us or None. She is a former political prisoner, and she was imprisoned for anti-imperialist actions in the 1970s and the 1980s. Linda has been a close ally of CR since being released in 2001. And I was thinking that you were a member of the committee, but yeah, you were in prison.
I was inside.
But she made up for it when she got out. So. She's done, there's so much in her bio, plan for a safer Oakland, invest in people, not police and prison. Stand up for youth. Reentry support for people coming home for prisons. And, Linda's just absolutely incredible. I don't know. There's so much here, Linda. I just want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for dedicating your life to this struggle. And the third person who will participate in the conversation is Mary Hooks. Mary is co-director of Southerners on New Ground. You're familiar with SONG, which is a home for LGBTQ liberation across all lines of race, class, abilities, age, culture, gender, sexuality, and it's in the South. Talking to Mary at NW, the National Women's Studies Association meeting. When was that? That was in November, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking her about the work she was doing, and she told me about this this project. It's called The Lord's Work. Are you familiar with it?
No.
Who wants to do the Lord's work? L-O-R-D-E.
Audre Lorde. Audre Lorde.
Audre Lorde's work. But I think I'm just going to move over. And I've been...
What a treat.
And I know we've done it before. I'll take another one. And I haven't seen Linda for a while, so okay. So there are a number of questions that that we would like you to address. This isn't working. I'm sorry, I'm a little taller than...
I was sitting in that chair.
When they did the mic check. Yeah, Linda was in the chair when they did the mic check, so... so, the first question we would like you to address is... how you became involved in the abolitionist movement. What was your entry point? When was it? Did it have anything to do with critical resistance? And maybe since you're the first person, Linda.
Since I'm the oldest, I remember.
Well, I'm older than you are, so.
I'm not sure about that. I was locked up in federal prison when the first critical resistance conference happened. And I remember very distinctly that Eve Goldberg, my partner, and I were working on an article. We had just decided to do this. I was studying neoliberalism, finishing college in prison, and felt like we needed to write something about how neoliberalism and global capitalism were affecting prisons and what prison had to do with that. So we were writing, Eve was going to the library, this is all very old school, going to the library, doing research in the library, looking up things in the, you know, those magazine indexes, Xeroxing things and sending them in to me in prison, trying to write together. It was quite a project. In the middle of this, a friend of mine who was visiting, another former political prisoner, Bo Brown, told me about an organization that was forming called Critical Resistance. I don't even know if that name existed then when Bo was telling me about it. And I remember being in awe that there was an organization forming that was going to try to abolish prisons. I felt like this is impossible. You know, I was in prison, hello. And I'm like, okay, good, let's abolish prisons, but how the heck are we gonna do it? She told me about a conference that was happening, and the Prison Activist Resource Center decided that they would publish our article, This is a pristine 20-year-old copy of the prison industrial complex and the global economy, which many of you hopefully have read, although it definitely needs updating. And this was an incredibly important connection for me as an activist locked up inside federal prison looking at a 40-year sentence, and the feeling that I could have a voice, and a voice that would be listened to and respected, and that I could be a part of building an abolitionist movement. So for me, the production of this and the inclusion of it in the registration packets of the conference was a tremendous connection and very important psychologically, emotionally, and I think helped me understand at a different level what really was going on outside. Because when you're locked up, it's very, very difficult to get any kind of information about what activists are doing, about what the political arguments are that are going on, what is of the moment. So I was extremely appreciative of that effort of critical resistance to include me and prisoners in the process of connecting with that first conference. And the other thing that I learned at the same time was about the Delano 2 campaign and the effort to prevent the construction of a prison in Delano, a second prison. The fact that people were going after prison construction in that time, when there had been 23 new prisons in the last 10 years built in California, was awe-inspiring and shocking. And I feel like it's very important for all of us here today to recognize that it was the unity of activists on the outside, the building of very unusual coalitions, including the environmental movement, including the NAACP and the ACLU, including a legislative strategy, including a litigation strategy, creative thinking built our movement. And I think that that's crucial for us to continue to engage in the level of discussion and strategizing that we need at a deep level to move forward. So those are the two entry points for me.
Mine is not nearly as intricate or glorious or brilliant as Linda framed for herself. I joined Critical Resistance in 2010. I came into CR after doing a lot of LGBT organizing, but mostly LNG, if you know what I mean. And I was really dissatisfied with the ways that it was not really having an impact on all of my people and all of my communities and all of the folks that I throw down with and for. And this little muffin named Isaac Loves Smonko, who I said I would name drop, kept inviting me to all these random things, like this town hall about these gang injunctions. And I went to some CR workshops at the US Social Forum in Detroit that year. And my mind was blown. I was like, I'm from Ohio. We don't have like ethnic studies and cultural studies and things like that in middle school. So like these were not things that I knew. I was new to California too. And I think after I went to those workshops, I joined CR like maybe 3 or 4 weeks later. There's this activity, if any of y'all have ever been to a CR workshop, where they have the concentric circles that talk about how the prison industrial complex is a set of interests that uses these tools, that impacts these problems, and impacts these people, all of these different parts, right? And I was like, those are my people. I see that thing. This is there too. Oh my gosh. And I had an understanding in that 2 hours of how abolition was going to help to liberate all of my people. Mm-hmm. And so I started showing back up. And at first I did prisoner mail. That was the first piece of the work that I did in CR, and then eventually I joined the Stop the Injunctions Coalition because the injunctions were happening like in the neighborhood where I was living. And that was the first campaign I ever participated in and the first campaign I ever won. And and I think like from then until now, my understanding of abolition has, yes. There you go. But yeah, that was how I joined
CR. It's really great to win the first campaign.
It is. I tell myself that now when I'm not winning. I'm like, that one time.
Wow, this is a great question, but I have to say thank you so much for the CR family for having me and for having Song. I sit as one, but represent thousands of dangerous queer and trans folks across the South who have been blessed and inspired by the work of CR. So thank you. Put the mic up, Junior. Thank you. And just shout out to Kara Page, who is a Deep Song fam and love that's in the audience. So yeah, I'll answer the question, because I could go on all night being gracious and grateful. But I would say that my entry point into abolition was how I entered movement. And many folks have heard this story before, but one night I was kicking it with my homies, and in our Leslie fashion was getting ready to go to a Ladies at Play party in Atlanta. Oh yes. And she spotted a hottie and was like, yo, Mary, go talk to her. Get the read. And no problem, I'm a good wingman. So I went over to this woman and I asked her, you know, just chopping it up. And I said, well, what do you do? Like, what do you do? And she's like, I'm trying to stop the shackling of black women while giving birth in prison. What? Yo, what? What? Blew my whole mind. I come from a place, my people are from Racine, Wisconsin. Ain't nobody really talking about that, you know? And they should, given how much Wisconsin is caging up our people. But she said that to me, and it blew my mind that it was happening, and it blew my mind that she was doing something about it. And I was like, what in the world? And that's when she became one of, my homie didn't get her, they didn't hook up, but we all became really great friends. And she said, I want to introduce you to my political home. And that was Southerners on New Ground. And that was Paris Hatcher. I don't know, many of you may know of her work with Black Feminist Futures. But Paris Hatcher was the woman in the bar that night. This was probably 2009, I believe, or so. And then in 2011, I believe it was, Kaila Mumbabaro joined the Song of Staff. My word, and blew our whole minds again. Kai's role at the time was to build the fighting arm and the campaign arm inside of Song and really strengthen our work when it comes down to campaigns. It's like, we want to win some stuff. Want to dismantle some stuff. And Kai, I remember we would sit in her house in Durham. And you know, Kai, who knows Kai Lumumba-Barre? Okay. If you know her, you got to love her, Lord. And she would be writing and drawing and art and music. And I remember like one time, like her heat went out. We just in there cold. I can't even describe to you the scenario in which we were in. And she just would tell us stories and complicate what we knew and understood about this work and how we what we understood about organizing and the broader fight that we were up against. And I don't think she was literally, her role was to like get our little scrappy selves together. A lot of us was new inside of the work of Song. And she spent years and we sat at her feet and many of the things that she taught us at the time we were like, I can't even, what is happening? I don't even know the language. What are you saying right now? But it was a lot of her that instilled in myself and others inside of Song the language and the analysis around the prison industrial complex and really, you know, held us to task. Like, if we gonna fight, don't be, oh, forget I'm in a church, I cuss. Regulate, self-regulate, get your stuff together. If we gonna be out here fighting, don't be on no BS. We gotta come with the real, and we can't just go for the things that aren't the crumbs for our people. And this is a longer term work and vision around abolition that we're here for. So I'll stop there, but that's how I got in.
Since this is a period in which we don't have a lot of victories to celebrate, and particularly since Kamau, you raised the question of becoming involved in the Stop Gang Injunctions campaign and experiencing a victory immediately, I was wondering if the rest of you could, or all of you could perhaps think about some important victories that you've been involved in relation to the abolitionist movement.
I'll start off talking about Stop the Injunctions Coalition, just because I think, it was successful and we won, but we were acting like we won before we even officially won, because I think it's important to define and frame victories beyond like what the definitions of the state offers up to us. So even before the injunctions got repealed, because that was 5 years after everything had started, even before that, we had tested and seen like they weren't actually being enforced. We were like, we won. Before that, we were building strong political relationships with folks all across Oakland, including Chicano Moratorium Coalition. And because of that, we said we won, because we had people who had been directly impacted listed on the gang injunctions, their loved ones were on the gang injunctions, and they were galvanized to start engaging in community-centered work and building out community-based solutions to increase public safety that weren't criminalizing and ostracizing their own people. Mm-hmm. We said that we won. And so way before they were officially deauthorized, way before we, you know, had the victory parties, we knew that in all of these particular ways we had won already. We built the skills of a lot of the members of Critical Resistance, including myself and many people who some are here and some aren't here, and I'm holding them all in my heart. But I think, yeah, we also pushed out police chiefs, 3, I believe. We got rid.
Thank you.
That's not to be on the NIMBY tip, that's to reflect like not to be on the not in my backyard tip, because unfortunately some of those police chiefs ended up in different cities, like Anthony Batts, who was in Baltimore when Freddie Gray was murdered. And so like, I don't wanna be like, we got rid of him and that's dope. He's still in other places ruining many people's lives and terrorizing communities. Mm-hmm. But it did give us the ability to show the power of the people and to put fear in the hearts of those decision makers who were trying to play folks to the left and act like this wasn't a big deal. And I think in those ways, and also in the shifting of the conversation around what is the purpose and impact of policing, what should public safety look like in Oakland, who does know what the solutions are, and it was the conversation and the messaging and the energy was, we know what our communities need, we know how to keep each other safe, and I think that has been something that has carried on into other anti-policing work and abolition work more broadly in Oakland, whether it's from Stop Urban Shield to closing down the San Francisco City Jail. Like, it's based on the fact that community members know what they need, community members are the experts in their experiences, mm-hmm. and because of those things, I think it's important to highlight the Stop the Injunctions Coalition and highlight like all the different angles of what victory means and what it looks like, and not just the like after 5 years it got deauthorized. Yeah.
Run it.
Okay. All righty, friends. I love this question for a lot of the same reasons that you unpacked. You know, I think for Song and for many folks in the South, in a red state, you know, policy victories are oftentimes, you know, far and few between. However, I think that inside of Song's work, we've been able to have a blessing of being able to work inside of coalitions and alliances that have been able for us to advance our vision of what a South free from fear looks like. And some of that has looked like some of our work when we started doing like some really like throwing down and doing direct action was alongside of one of our comrade organizations, the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights. And this is at the time when the Arizona anti-immigration bills were begin spreading across the South, and Georgia had adopted its version of it. And part of that work was being able to dismantle some of the things that they had in there, one of which was deeply important, where they were going to begin arresting folk who were caught with folk who were undocumented, saying that we could not be sanctuary for each other. And that was one of the interventions we were able to make together. I think over the last few years, we're feeling victorious, you know, for the leaders we've been able to develop and bring into the work. Some of the leadership development pipelines, like the fellowship program, the Lord's work, and seeing the results of that, and many have come to the work through the Mama's Day Bailout campaign work, which is highlighting the crisis. Blessings.
And the time is 8 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Ender. How are you? And this is the slot for Squirrel Snow. So before we head to just listen to some music, we are going to take a peek at very important KBOO messages.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Concert for the Village, Saturday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Sabood House in Portland. Concert for the Village is a benefit for the Rafiki Village Project, whose mission is to improve health, increase literacy, and promote economic prosperity in Tanzanian villages. The concert features performances by Okadija, an Afropop singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist from Ghana, and Sepharine from Portland. There will also be food, drinks, an auction, and more. Again, that's Concert for the